We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman, here with my Bitch Talk co-hosts Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. And we've got a little VR roundtable we're going to do right now, focusing on the VR projects Ghost Fleet and Traveling While Black. We have Shannon Service, the director of Ghost Fleet, Lucas Gath, the director and cinematographer on Ghost Fleet, and Aisha Nataraja, who's the co-director on Traveling While Black. Am I correct?
You got it right.
I see you all nodding as I'm going down the line.
Nodding doesn't work on radio.
Well, thank you guys for being here. We always love to do a specific focus on VR, and these are two wonderful projects. I was actually looking forward to Ghost Fleet because I knew John Bowerman is a part of it, and he had talked about it at the EarthX Film Festival last year, about it being in progress. So I was, again, very enthusiastic to see that. But let's introduce our listeners to what these are. So Shannon, why don't you tell us about Ghost Fleet?
Sure. Ghost Fleet is, we have two things. We have a documentary feature and we have a VR experience that's here at Sundance. And both really dive into this watery underworld of slavery at sea, and particularly on Thai fishing boats. Thailand is one of the biggest suppliers of fish to the U.S. They have an enormous fishing fleet, so big that they've actually cleared out the Gulf of Thailand and now go all around the world as far away as Ethiopia looking for fish. And as they go, fishermen don't want to be out for years away from their family, so they've started going to other sectors, and rather than being able to fly the men home or improving the conditions or upping the pay, a lot of vessel owners have decided to buy men off of human trafficking gangs. So a guy will walk into a bar and wake up on board a boat and just be surrounded by water for 10 years. And a lot of this fish, as I said, comes to the U.S. So the amazing thing about what Lucas's idea to really bring VR into the shoot was to put people on the boats. And it's such an incredible experience because most people actually have no idea just the mental, like the crazy mental thing of being on a boat and not seeing land, and to really be in this experience as you're meeting this man. And we hope is a powerful transformative one.
It really is. And we want to talk about that, but first, Aisha, tell us about Traveling While Black.
Yeah, so Traveling While Black is a virtual reality documentary. It is about the restriction of movement of African Americans dating back to the 40s and spinning to present day. Similarly to what Shannon said, we felt that this story needed to be told in VR because this is an experience that African Americans have on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. But to watch a film isn't the same experience as sitting face-to-face with someone and hearing of their experiences and feeling like you're a part of the story. So we felt that VR was the best way to do it.
No, absolutely. I mean, anyone who's visited the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis and is like, you know, literally sat in the bus, you know, been at the hotel there, you know, it's transformative to do that. And Ghost Fleet is about 8 minutes long. Traveling While Black is a 20-minute experience. Now, Ghost Fleet, because it does sit you literally next to our host, who's basically telling us his experience. And as you look around yourself, you're on the boat with him, you're on the ship, you're seeing men working. So talk about the filmmaking process, Lucas, of VR versus the actual documentary, the other straight documentary that you did.
Yeah, I mean, so we, all three of us, come from that documentary process of finding the way to tell the story, right? And that language and that vocabulary of what's a wide shot and what's a close-up and how we communicate each story and how we create those feelings. And that changes massively with VR. Sometimes if I want to, like, really be able to show you what a boat looks like, I'll go on the corner with a film camera when we're shooting a documentary and try and show you the whole thing. But now we have to change the way that we look at it. We have to put ourselves in the middle of it. It needs to be interesting all around you. It can't be interesting only looking in one direction. So we started thinking about that. And like Shannon said, I think that was the reason why we decided to make this film in VR. I think Traveling While Black and Ghost Fleet are two experiences that have one thing in common, which is they put you in a place where you can look around and there's a lot of things that you can find out. There's a lot of information, and that's the reason why we really did it. Like Shannon mentioned, I mean, it's really, really hard for us to understand what it's like to be surrounded by water. Mm-hmm. These people don't have shackles. They don't have bars. They're free in a way, but they're free on a boat surrounded by water. That's right. Our prison.
Right.
Yeah, that's definitely, it definitely comes across. And that's what I was thinking too, because I visited Alcatraz and places like that. And of course the bars and you're held, but you can see land and you can imagine something, but there it's just, there's no hope. It's just, it's so hopeless and stark and they don't know anyone. They don't know each other. And it really came across as really powerful.
Thank you. I mean, they often don't speak the same language. Mm-hmm. And because a lot of the men who are kidnapped are coming from Myanmar, also known as Burma, and from Cambodia, you know, these are countries that were at war with each other for a long time. So imagine suddenly not only waking up on board a boat, but you're waking up in a situation where you might be the only person who speaks your language, and you're with 10 other men inside the space of an 18-wheeler, and there's just, you know, incredible violence. Nobody wants to be there, and basically suppressed with a huge amount of violence. And so I think that that's the other thing that really ties our projects together, is just the trying to put people who have no idea, who can't, you know. I mean, I as a white woman, a white-skinned woman, have no idea what it's like to travel while black, and I have to say that experiencing Aisha's project like left me so shaken and so forever changed. There's such an incredible level of empathy that is possible in VR that, you know, we hope people feel with Ghost Fleet, but being able to experience someone else's that is just so well done, it completely changed me.
Well, Aisha, that's a great segue to you. let's talk about it. Let's talk about the challenges of, one, you know, giving out the information that you want to give out in a document, as any documentary filmmaker would want, but then adding this kind of visceral, tactile element of placing us right there.
Yeah, so I have to say thank you to Shannon and Lucas. I think they've made me cry like 4 times this weekend with their 5 words once a day. But yeah, so I co-directed this film with Roger Ross Williams, and both of us come from a traditional documentary background. This was both of our first VR films. And it was definitely a learning process, but we did this film in partnership and in collaboration with Felix and Paul Studios, and we could not have asked for better collaborators to help guide us through this process. For Felix and Paul, they also say that this has been an incredible learning experience for them as well, because we brought our formal documentary background into VR in a way that they hadn't experienced. Mm. So it was definitely a process. We all learned a lot, but Roger and I, when we were working on this, just stuck to our documentary roots. Mm-hmm. So we did film in Ben's Chili Bowl, which is a historic location in Washington, D.C. This film is about travel, but it's also about safe spaces and the creation of safe spaces, and Ben's Chili Bowl in Washington, D.C. is one of those places. And so when we were thinking about the film, we said, we're going to get real people who are the patrons of Ben's. So to find our subjects, I was making trips down to DC on a weekly basis and meeting with Virginia Ali, the owner of Ben's, who you meet in the film. And two of the men that are in the film are leaders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, mm-hmm. Cortland Cox and Frank Smith. And I met them at Ben's, sitting at the counter. Mm-hmm. They were just there eating their lunch.
In real life.
In real life. Yeah. And Virginia was like, oh, meet my friends. And I was like, okay. And then I start talking to them and hear their background. And I'm like, oh my goodness, you guys were on the front lines and still are. And so it was an incredible experience. But then working with Felix and Paul to then say, this is the kind of film that we want to make. This is how we would do it. And then learning from them. So for us, instead of doing interviews, Felix and Paul said, but then that means the filmmaker will be in the film, because, or we wipe them and it looks like they're not talking to anyone. So by plating, all of a sudden there's just one person talking and it doesn't really make sense. So they told us, why don't we set up conversations? And it's just little things like that, that working together with collaborators like Felix and Paul I think we were able to make the best possible film that we could have. Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to bring up, this was my first time experiencing VR ever. Can you talk about that process for our audience? Because I don't know if a lot of people have actually watched a film in virtual reality.
Well, you mean about like the process of making the film, of how we shoot
in VR?
Well, so basically, because we are shooting in 360 degrees, we're shooting every direction. I think that's the interesting thing is when you ask about the process, if you ask about the filmmaking process, there's a million film schools that would say the same thing that's been done for over 100 years. VR is in diapers.
Yeah.
There's no real process. Right. We're reinventing it every single day. There's a lot of course, things that we take off of each other, but essentially, like, it's a camera that is filming in every direction. Like, the first VR experience that I did was here at Sundance. That was History of Cuban Dance with Lucy Walker. And we went to Cuba, and we would, like, put cameras in, like, in certain places and tell people what to do, and then we would go hide. And then we would hope, but we had no way to, like, monitor it. Like, we had no idea. In fact, like, I was hiding. If you look in one of the shots, like, my foot is sticking out because I'm hiding it. And I couldn't see my foot was sticking out. But that was VR. Like, it's sort of like, it's this theater where you're trying to, like, understand what you're about to do, but you're hoping for the best in a lot of times. So a lot of the resources that we have in film don't exist. They don't apply. We can't have that same conversation, and the narrative filmmaking brings a lot to the table, but the technical side of it changes massively, and now we have to reinvent it. And the example that I always give is, it took more than 20 years for someone to do the first close-up in films. We don't have that yet. That's where we are. Like, we need to figure out those type of things that are so basic for filmmaking that it's filmmaking 101, and we don't have them yet. So
it's exciting, though. Yeah.
It's really exciting. It's every conversation is like with this filmmakers and when any other filmmaker is, what do you do? What could we do? What has not been done? And there's so much that hasn't been done that I think for me it's really, really exciting. It's constantly like, you gotta be thinking out of the box. But every day you're given the opportunity to do something very, very special and very unique.
Well, it's been wild as someone that has experienced this growth of VR since it was kept in a little tiny closet in the bottom of one building here on Main Street to what we have now, where it's like taken over Main Street. It's a different building. And VR has come out of the closet, exactly. But your two projects really exemplify the fact that it's a new technology, but when it comes down to it, it's really about the story you're telling, and it's really about the heart that you're trying to touch. And again, we've been talking about Ghost Fleet and Traveling While Black. We've had Shannon Service and Lucas Gath here from Ghost Fleet, and Aisha Nataraja here from Traveling While Black. Thank you both all for being here.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk podcast on KCPW, kcpw.org, bff.fm, and kfog.com. You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman, here with the Bitch Talk co-hosts Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. This segment is about the film Bedlam. It's a documentary screening at Sundance. We have the director of the film, Kenneth Paul Rosenberg, and one of the subjects in the film, Patrice Kohlers. Welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Ken, this is the part of the show where we have our filmmaker introduce our listeners who have not seen the film yet.
Great.
What is the film about?
So the film is about the tragedy and the trajectory of the seriously mentally ill in America. We have really largely abandoned this population. Mm-hmm. We've mistreated them. We've jailed them. We've made it a crime to be mentally ill in America. Mm-hmm. The mental institutions are few and far between. The jails are the now de facto mental institutions. The streets are the new community mental health centers, and where our people congregate in Skid Row, where we filmed. So we want to bring people's attention to that, and we want to bring people to advocacy, and we're lucky enough to film among other people, Patrice Kohlers, who has been kind of, you know, the advocacy poster child for this, and we're so grateful that she was agreed to be in the film.
Well, there's a lot to unpack with this, and frankly, you know, we could do a separate show on your personal story in connection with this, with your sister, with the various case studies, or with the overall approach. I mean, that is what I think is so wonderful about this film, is that you've managed to, I think, in a very deft manner, weave all of that together to tell the story. Talk about your personal connection to this.
Sure. So I became a psychiatrist because my sister had schizophrenia. And I made this film because my sister died from schizophrenia. And I thought it's really incredibly important to share that story. It's not something I intended to do, frankly. I intended to make a film. Lord, I intended to make a film in about a month or two. It took about 5 or 6 or 7 years. But I went where the film, you know, took me. I mean, that's my job as a filmmaker, to go where the material takes me. And ultimately, what the material said to me is I needed to bookend this film and include myself, because people were watching the film but not really understanding why, what was behind it. We certainly make it clear that this is an important issue, but why is it an important issue that a filmmaker was never known? And I thought it was really important to share that personal story as well as my professional story, which is I'm a psychiatrist.
Well, as an audience member, I think it made it. Knowing what was driving you, helped, propel me along the story with you. And I also really appreciated the fact, you know, maybe you didn't intend to have it take that long as you were filming, but I really appreciated each one of your case studies when you would return to them a few months later or a couple years later or something like that, because, you know, that is something I think for myself that you see what's present before you, and oftentimes you're not thinking about what is going to follow.
Absolutely.
And what follows that, and Patricia, I would love for you to talk about one, agreeing to be a part of it, and allow the cameras on you and allowing this guy to tell your story and have you tell us about the experience having that.
It was honestly deeply collaborative. In some ways, Ken's style of directing isn't, trying to tell a story. He really would sit and talk and have conversations with me and my family, and every step of the way wanted to know how we felt, if we were comfortable. And it was an incredibly healing process, to be honest with you. And we started filming before I became sort of known for Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter didn't exist at that time. In fact, I was really doing local advocacy work, trying to stop a mental health jail. And I put that in quotes because there's no such thing as a mental health jail. And because of my brother's experience inside of the LA County jails, and because he was both diagnosed in the same place that he was tortured, it was incredibly important for me to be a part of this film, because I wanted the story of Black folks in particular who've suffered from severe mental illness to tell our stories. It's a huge issue in the Black community around mental health and mental illness, and I would argue largely in communities of color where we don't really talk about it, or we're told to pray about it, or we're told that we don't suffer from those things. My family was different. My mother, once she found out about my brother's mental illness, we really tried to advocate on his behalf. And what you see in the film over and over again is sort of the battle of, us as his advocates, and also a big criminal justice system that has criminalized his mental illness instead of providing him care.
Mm-hmm. Well, and his story is not the only one that is affecting in that way, where we see the guy he can be, and the guy he at times is, and then are crushed every time, there's a setback, and Ken, I think, illustrating, using those and illustrating that there are countless stories like that.
More stories than not.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the normal trajectory of serious mental illness, that it's a refractory disease. In other words, people come to that disease state again and again. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, and I think something, a message Patrice and I really want to convey, is it doesn't need to be that way. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. We don't, mental illness should not be a crime. Treatments and medications should not be 70 to 80 years old. Mm-hmm. We should be much further along. And the way we'll get there, frankly, is not simply by making films, but by campaigning for ourselves and our family members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that one of the effects that the film had on me, it was very powerful, was just the appreciation for these little things that we have and that we have access to. And mm-hmm. I mean, they want a job, they want a roof over their heads. Yeah. And in the case of Todd, I remember, mm-hmm. you know, he's aware of his illness, he knows that he needs help, he needs medication, but he doesn't have access to it. Mm-hmm. So he's like, if I don't have access to it, I'm gonna get sick again. And exactly. He's just kind of like, it's like a ticking clock. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's so frustrating to see. And we have the tools and the resources, it's just not being allocated properly. So it's really frustrating. And
oh yeah, it's not a money problem. We spend a lot of money on jails mm-hmm. and police as mm-hmm. first responders. Mm-hmm. If we allocate that money properly in psychiatric beds and outpatient treatment and not mm-hmm. jail beds, mm-hmm. we would get pretty far just with that alone. Mm-hmm. But you know, we need to do that for ourselves. And the first thing is, and this is kind of, I guess, the point of the film, is we need to come out of our shame. Mm-hmm. We need to, mm-hmm. you know, say, you know, okay, we have mental illness, our family members have mental illness, it's not a shame, it's not a crime. And then, mm-hmm. darn it, you know, we need some things, and you need to give it to us. Mm-hmm. And we need to do that as a kind of undeterred community, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And again, I think no one personifies it better than Patrice.
Let's talk about your filmmaker approach on this a little bit. Because of the case studies, you are... you know, having to follow the trajectory of each one of these, you know, each one of these people, and how did you go about that? I mean, were you calling them routinely? Were you emailing them? Did you have a friend or a family member that you're checking in with? How did you do that?
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I would check on people as much as I can. It was very, very hard to do that at times because someone like Todd, who's homeless, living mm-hmm. on the streets, it took us a year to find him, and then he might disappear for another year or even two. I would have to go to Skid Row and find him myself. So it's not an easy process, but you know, other folks, I mean, as much as I can, I'm like, how you doing? And it's not just, when can we film you? It's like, literally, how you doing and what's going on? And it's really quite honestly a blessing for me that I've become like a part of, you know, these folks' lives. And the film, I think, reflects that. But it's just, you know, people say, well, what are you, a filmmaker? Are you a psychiatrist? Mm-hmm. And I think I'm just kind of trying to do my thing, honestly. And in doing that thing, I'm able to kind of connect to these people constantly.
And then how did you go about striking the balance between those case studies, between your personal story that is weaved throughout, and again, the politics of the issue and the aspect of it?
Well, I think we took a deep dive into it. I think that I decided, just like I was going to share my own story without editing, I was going to share the professional story without editing. Mm. And psychiatry, for, you know, certainly in the last century, abandoned these patients. I mean, let's just kind of say that really clearly. Mm-hmm. Psychiatry abandoned its sickest patients. Mm-hmm. How messed up mm-hmm. is that? Mm-hmm. And I thought that, you know, if I'm taking on my own story, I got to take on psychiatry's story as well. And we took a deep dive into that and interviewed, you know, very well-meaning people, the presidents of the American Psychiatric mm-hmm. Association, who say over and over again, we messed up. And, you know, we have to do it right.
So Patrice, what would you say to someone like me who watches this film and is outraged? What are the next steps? Certainly this film coming out and being at Sundance and spreading the message, what are some steps that we can take to help in the movement?
I mean, folks are going to understand that this is not just a Los Angeles issue, this is a national crisis. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that people should be joining the organizations that are trying to deal with this crisis right now and or starting organizations, because already many people have told me that my family story resonates with them because they've had the same exact issue, but they had no idea what to do with it. So organizing, campaigning, being a part of the solution, joining something, because we can't change it alone. This film is not going to change it alone, but it's a part of a larger advocacy effort to expose and to remind people where we need to be investing our dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, the film is Bedlam. It is a deep dive into a very tough subject, and it's one of those films that you see and you just want to immediately email a dozen people and tell them to go see the film. Again, we've had Kenneth Paul Rosenberg, the director of the film, Patrice Cullors, who is in the film. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk podcast on KCPW, kcpw.org, bff.fm, and kfog.com. Next up, we're on location for a Riot Films and IDA documentary roundtable with our executive producer, Lancia Wan.
And I am here with Carrie Lozano from IDA, that's the International Documentary Association, as well as Haley Pappas from Riot Films. And I am Lancia Wan, stepping in for John Wildman. This is going to be our documentary roundtable session because you guys are both very, very familiar with documentaries. So if you wouldn't mind, maybe introduce yourselves and kind of go through a little bit of your background, what you do with IDA and Riot, respectfully. And maybe let's start with you, Carrie.
Sure. My name is Carrie Lozano. I'm the director of the Enterprise Documentary Fund at IDA. And by background, I'm a filmmaker and a journalist. And a couple of years ago, with support from the MacArthur Foundation, we launched a fund, a grant-making fund, that would support documentary films that intersect with journalism. And we are super excited to be here because we have four films that we supported who are premiering here this week.
Tell us the films.
Do you want to just know the titles, or?
Let's do the titles really quick, and then.
Okay.
Yeah.
Knock Down the House.
Mm-hmm.
Life Overtakes Me, Always in Season, and One Child Nation.
And then Haley, if you could introduce yourself.
Yes. Hi. I'm Haley Pappas. I oversee Riot Films. So we are a documentary film studio that commissions, finances, produces a slate of documentaries, both features, shorts, that, you know, focus on a variety of different subjects. We're lucky that we don't necessarily have any editorial mandate that we have to fill. I think that we are passionate about telling character-driven stories from visionary and artistic filmmakers that hope to give sort of often a more human lens to a variety of different topics and subjects. Background is in film and worked with nonprofits as well. This year we have two films here. We have one feature documentary called The Disappearance of My Mother, and then another feature documentary with Magnolia from director Allison Clayman and producer Marie Therese, The Brink.
Yeah, that's awesome. And not only have you guys been in documentary making and like that sort of stuff for a long time, but you also are filmmakers yourselves.
So my first film that I produced, The Weather Underground, premiered here in 2003. So last year was our 15-year Sundance anniversary. Sam Green's actually here today, too. And as we were leading up to our Sundance premiere, I dropped in my application to the Graduate School of Journalism at Berkeley, not knowing what would happen to the film or to my application. In my second year at the J School, we were nominated for an Academy Award. So it was a very unusual set of circumstances.
How did you juggle all of that? That is an incredible amount going on at once.
It was a really, really odd and fantastic year.
Yeah.
I'll just put it that way, yeah.
And then, Haley, I know you do a lot of VR as well. I believe Dinner Party, was that last year, Sundance, right?
Dinner
I believe we interviewed them as well.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah,
so I used to oversee all of our immersive content as well. Riot Films just now focuses on documentaries, but worked a lot in immersive content, both virtual reality and augmented reality. We have a number of projects here this year, from The Dial, Jester's Tale, and of course, now I'm going to forget the third. We have a third project here. My God, I feel horrible. Gloomy Eyes, I think it might be. But yeah, we're continuing to work in the immersive space to try to sort of push the boundaries of what storytelling looks like as technologies emerge and new formats continue to develop.
Right. And how different is that, working on a VR sort of documentary versus what you did with perhaps On Her Shoulders?
They're very different. Very different in countless ways. You know, I think that there are similarities in storytelling and creators and creatives, period. But the format is quite different.
Mm-hmm.
The production itself is quite different. Financing is very different.
But again, I think that, like, from a director's perspective, it's still a matter of, you know, arc and emotion. And frankly, the questions are, what does directing look like in an immersive space rather than in a framed shot? So, yeah, I think it lends itself to a longer conversation, but, yeah, they can be rather different beasts.
And the exhibition, too,
yeah,
right?
The exhibition, I mean, the distribution, the audience consumption. You know, I think often immersive is seen as, like, the next step of video. I don't personally feel that way. I feel like immersive content relates more to, like, theatrical performances or almost literature, perhaps, where you have full imaginative spaces. But anyways.
And do you typically focus on, like, social justice? Because your background is a lot in social justice and issues like that.
So we don't have a mandate for that. I think that probably because of our background and because of our founders' missions, you know, to connect stories with actions, we tend to be more drawn towards stories that feel like they have a sense of timeliness and purpose. But I think that that can translate into any variety of stories, right? I don't think it needs to be like a heavy-hitting social justice news piece to have an impact. And I feel like the IDA shares similar values. I think that, you know, small, intimate character portraits about an everyday person going through the everyday steps of life can be just as impactful in many ways.
Yeah, definitely. And then, Carrie, I know a lot of the films through the Enterprise Fund at IDA is through a journalism aspect, taking these possibly very small teams, working through them in a journalistic approach, whereas they don't have, like, the resources that bigger films do. Can you talk a little bit about how you guys approach the way that you do your funding and your films and the production and process of those?
Sure. One of the biggest questions we get is, what do you mean by the journalism? And, you know, our response is it means a lot of different things. It depends on the film. So if it's an investigative film, a lot of it has to do with, well, what are your sources? How do you corroborate your allegations? I mean, this is something in Always in Season that they have to contend with. They're investigating what happened. It's like, how do you do that? Are your sources credible? Are you having lawyers look at your piece beforehand and vet it? And, you know, trying to kind of give that kind of guidance and support. And we have incredible partners with the UCLA Documentary Legal Clinic and with Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press, who actually work with our filmmakers in a variety of capacities. So that's one way of looking at it. But also, some projects are just super deeply researched. We have a number of films where they're really refreshing and new ideas, or, you know, things we haven't really seen. And so they require a huge amount of research. And then sometimes it has a lot more to do with just an approach that is really exploring something that's complicated and doing it in a way that's really balanced. Not necessarily that it's going to have, you know, everybody's point of view, but that the filmmaker is taking that into consideration. So we try to be really, really open with independence about what that means. And the onus is on them to explain to us what their journalistic process is, what their challenges are, what they might need. But really, we have an extensive review panel that often includes, or always includes, journalists who have nothing to do with documentary film, who really look at the stories on their merits. And I think that that actually has been a fascinating process for us and really insightful.
Do you feel like it's the turnaround for a documentary with the journalistic approach? Does it have to be a little more timely to try and get it out there, get it in front of audiences? For example, Knock Down the House. If you want to maybe talk to us a little bit about that film so our audience knows.
Yeah, so this is a film, you know, that when they submitted to us was following four women who had never been part of the political process, who were running for political office. One of those women happened to be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And, you know, obviously the rest is history. And basically, I just had lunch with them. When they got the grant, they suddenly had the finances to finish at this time, you know, to really get it out there at the moment when it would resonate the most. So some of them have that kind of a peg, although we weren't anticipating that. While others, you know, might take longer to germinate. So we don't necessarily feel like it has to be have a news hook, you know. Some of them do, but that's not the necessity. But they have to be revelatory. It has to be something we really feel like is taking a fresh perspective on something we might think we know about.
When you mentioned that they were sort of newer to the climate and newer to the process, do you think your journalistic background as a copy editor and journalism at different spots in your background, do they help kind of mold the documentary so that it has a little more direction, or do you find you have to do that a lot?
So we are, you know, we consider ourselves philanthropists, which is a new role for me. And I, you know, I have worked in a newsroom. And so our goal is to really be editorially hands off unless they ask for editorial support. And sometimes they'll come to me, sometimes they'll come to Simon. So we're happy to give it, but we really are fairly hands-off and just kind of a resource to them if and when they need us.
Haley, with your films and documentaries, what do you guys go look for? Because it's not necessarily always social justice, and it's not always necessarily this one avenue. Yeah, what is it that stands out to you? And
yeah, I think that there are a few things. I think on the one hand, it's partially just, you know, what resonates with us. What do we see that we're deeply moved by or inspired by or, see something particularly special there. I know that's such a vague and general response, but it really is true. I heard somebody mention it recently. It's almost like having a crush. It's like, you just know when you have the feeling, like you're like, oh, I love it. So there's a bit of that. There are some things that we gravitate more towards or that we don't do as much. We don't do that many like talking heads type films. That's just not really where we have the experience or background and not quite our aesthetic. We're comfortable with more experimental pieces. We're comfortable with character verite films. We're comfortable, you know, with things that take on a more sort of poetic approach to things. I think that we also try to be really cognizant of what value can we add. So I would say that it's a bit of a dual, you know, we look at things through two lenses. One, what is this film? How do we feel about the film? But two, what can we bring to the film? Is it something that where we can actually add value? Great. But if it actually is something that, like, we are here to support you and champion you all the way, but we actually may not be the best partner for this, I think we try to be really cognizant and transparent and honest and open with the filmmakers about that and have a real discussion around what do you need, where do you need it, how and where can we step in and add value versus where do you just need a check to be written as well, because that is a viable and real need.
As a nonprofit looking for money all the time, we definitely know about the money and the checks. Are there any projects on the horizon, anything that you can maybe talk about from both of you? Maybe we'll start with you, Haley.
Sure. So over this past summer, we launched equity co-fund between Riot Films and Vice Studios. So it was really transformative for us, gave us so many more resources to play with. Only it had a bit of like a time stamp on it. We essentially had to green light the entire fund now by the end of March. So we've been actively looking at and reviewing projects and green lighting those. So there's a slate of quite a few projects. We have yet to formally announce any of them, so I don't want to speak too soon. But there'll be a slate of projects coming out from there that are premiering 2019 all the way through to 2021, so on and so forth. But it's funny actually, because somebody this morning was asking, they were like, where do you find your films or filmmakers? And I was like, oh, you know, summer relationships. I was like, actually a lot come through partners like the IDA, you know, and I think it's important for us to have open dialogues and conversations and ongoing with partners like the IDA, since they are so often the first resource to really, you know, put a stamp on films that say we believe in you, and that's very important for us.
Cool. And Carrie?
Well, we at the end of February we'll be announcing our recent slate of development grantees.
Awesome.
And you know what's really exciting about that for us is that that's the place where we can support more emerging filmmakers, where we can take some creative risks, you know, things that might be harder at the production side to convince of the kind of journalistic approach that we're taking. On the development side, you really can say, hey, develop this, let's see where it goes, and give them a leg up. So we're really excited because there are a real range of projects, and artistically some of them are filmmakers who have a very, very artistic aesthetic, and so we're super happy about that. And of course we have our films premiering here, and we have a film premiering, Ernie and Joe, which is a lovely film about two police officers who are handling mental health calls in a totally new way, and that's premiering at South by Southwest. So there's a lot to look forward to. And then there's the rest of 2019 too.
And then Always in Season, that was a Firelight documentary. Did you work with Firelight at all, or is that sort of a separate?
So I actually met Jackie here last year as part of the industry meetings, and we have a grant that we give to two women, emerging women of color each year, and she was one of them.
Oh, awesome.
And, you know, it was one of those meetings where you have the 10-minute speed dating, and that's how we met Jackie and got in touch with that project and really felt like it was so strong and so important.
Thank you guys so much. This is Lancia with The Daily Buzz, and I was just talking to Haley Pappas from Riot Films, as well as Carrie Lozano from IDA. Thank you, ladies.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast. My name is John Wildman, here with the Bitch Talk women, Erin Lim and Angela Tabora. Right now, we're going to be talking about Vice Studio. We have a round table, and we have Natalie Ferry, who's the head of film at Vice, and we have Danny Gabay, the head of Vice Studios. Welcome for the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, so tell us about Vice Films. Tell us about Vice Studios for, and let's not assume that everybody knows.
Vice Studios is the film and TV studio arm of Vice Media. So right. We're the company that does the crazy new show on HBO. We put out a magazine for 25 plus years at this point. We have a series of digital channels. We have an ad agency. And Vice has been dabbling in films for over a decade now. We started off making a lot of feature-length documentaries that we ran at different festivals over the years and put out in different DIY sorts of ways. Started to pick them up doing bigger documentaries a number of years ago. I think I'd say the first real kind of breakout documentary we had on a more global level would have been our Jim Carrey documentary, Jim and Andy, that we ended up running on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And about a year ago, we started to say, how do we take our film and TV business a little bit more seriously? And how do we double down on it and, really start to think about how to back the artists that we love in a bigger way? And I'd say about 7 years ago when I came to the company, we decided to start dabbling in developing out bigger films and different kinds of films and working with maybe a broader range of filmmakers than we were doing before. And what's happened, which has been pretty magical, is about a year ago, a lot of these projects really started to come to fruition at the same time. And that was the moment when we said, okay, we need to do this seriously. So instead of being a one and a half person skunk works hiding in a cubby hole somewhere off to the side of Vice, we brought Natalie in and we said, let's do this seriously. And
let's do this for reals.
Yeah.
Let's try it. Let's see what happens.
We can do this.
And we delivered 10 movies last year, of which they're all starting to come out this year. We have three at this festival. Our documentary on the Fire Festival premiered on Netflix about a week ago.
Oh, wow.
And two movies opening in February, two movies opening in March, two films at Berlin, a film at South by Southwest, and seven TV shows set up in the last year. But,
you guys got a couple things going on. So it's good that you got out of that little closet office space.
Fun to have some windows. But really, I should point it to Natalie because...
Yeah.
She was the person we said we needed to bring in when we were going to do this reel, and I feel like speaking to kind of where you came from how you approach stuff is really important to that.
Yeah, Natalie, give us some insight of what that process was for you to actually take a full on production approach to this as opposed to one or two films here and there.
Well, before I started at Vice, I was working with Spike Jonze for over a decade, so helping him take his whatever the project he wanted to do, we did like features, shorts, music videos, commercials, help him create this thing from start to finish. So I really had this amazing perspective of doing something from the first word on the page to the very last press interview. And through that experience, I figured out how to think creatively about what would Spike do? What do we do in this situation? How do we handle this? And so that's like the approach I bring to the studio, which is really trying to be very, very specific about what we're doing and why is this happening and how do you feel when you're making... I'm just talking creatively about specifics now and scripts and stuff, but really I love to take everything from the very beginning to the very end.
Well, here's the thing, and Vice has a very specific brand. We have a very specific idea in our head when we think of Vice, and so for documentaries, then we can go. Well, it's easy to make that translation and go, okay, well, this would be a Vice subject. This would be something that Vice would be interested in, and this is something that I can kind of have an idea in my head. The angle that Vice is going to take on this.
Right.
But for narrative film, that's a whole different thing.
Yep.
So talk about that.
So that would be the type of films we are making are relevant to what is happening in the world today. Everything has a very, very strong or unique perspective or point of view. And then strong characters at the core, really being able to emotionally connect with the subjects.
And I think also on that unique perspective, part, I think for us, it's why we end up working with so many auteur filmmakers and people that approach things in a really unique to them way.
And because, fearless.
Yeah. it's, you know, it's not just saying, hey, we're going to tell a story that no one else is going to hear. It's us saying, how are we going to do it in a way that no one else is thinking about? And really working with auteurs with very original voices just ends up becoming a really key piece in all of that. And I think maybe if you even want to speak to some of the films that we have here as examples to those points you were talking
about. Yeah, please do. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, a great example is Judy and Punch, written and directed by Mira Falks. She is somebody that Vice had been working with before I got there. She had done a few short films, and Danny said she'd be perfect for this particular project, and luckily she said okay. But she took this...
I think what she actually said was, this is the worst idea I ever heard. But you're going to pay me to write this? Well, you know, I'll give it a try.
Or maybe she said that.
Yeah.
But she took this old Punch and Judy puppet show from the 15th century, turned it on its head, and created this live-action film, darkly comedic, female-driven revenge story that is just amazing and has so much heart, and I'm so proud of that film. But that's a perfect example of what we're doing at the studio and the filmmakers we're working with. And of course, Scott Burns and
Newport. Kind of on the one end of the spectrum, you have Mira, who did this Mia Wasikowska film we have premiering tonight, which, you know, Kenny Turan said it was like a costume drama meets a Clockwork Orange. But, you know, ultimately it's this metaphor for how women are treated in the world today. And, it's crazy because it's something we've been developing with Mira for a number of years, but it really feels like it lines up with what's going on in the world with Me Too and Time's Up and, you know, all of these things that are coming out there now. But on the flip side, Scott Burns, you know, and that's totally done with world creation and a totally original story, looking at very relevant details. With Scott Burns' movie, The Report, which we premiered yesterday, that's taking a story that Vice News was really covering in the headlines and... looking at the CIA's torture program, the architects of that torture program, the CIA's attempt to stop the Senate from releasing the information about what happened in that torture program, and one man's hero's journey to try and uncover what really happened there, this guy Daniel Jones. So Scott Burns, we started talking to him about that project 5 years ago, but it was all very conceptual, and it was, hey, let's give you some creative guidance, let's talk about how we can be helpful to you here. We're not in the business, we're not a film studio at this point, but let's see how we can guide you. Luckily, we kept talking to him. He didn't get the movie made, and by the time we really all came back together, we were able to help him get that done and get it to the finish line. And he made an incredible movie that, you know, is totally realistic, completely based on true events. You know, every bit of it really excruciatingly checked for detail, but it's just a wildly engaging thriller at the same time.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, like, I'm looking through the list of directors and filmmakers, and you got Scott Burns. You know, you've got Soderbergh, you got Rick Alverson, you've got Jonas Åkerlund, Gaspar Noé, you know, Harmony Korine. It's almost like the Suicide Squad of film directors.
Yeah.
You know, and so I look at that and I'm going, awesome. You know, this is the place that I want to set up camp at. But it's one thing to have those really high profile, really out there auteurs sometimes, people that are really pushing. But now what about developing new talent and new voices? What are you guys doing in that regard?
That's super important to us. Maybe I'll start this and kick it off to you. But, you know, one of the very first things we did when we started playing with narrative film is we started working with Anna Lily Amirpour on her movie, Your Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. Mm-hmm. So we did that film with her, helped her get that out in the world, and then we produced her movie.
And bless you for doing that.
Thank you. And then we produced her movie, The Bad Batch, with Annapurna. And, you know, that was an incredible experience because we literally went from helping her with a $35,000 black and white Farsi language film that she shot out in the desert to, doing this movie that ended up premiering at the Venice Film Festival, and we won the special jury prize there. And, you know, watching her grow along that trajectory was super exciting. And now she's established. She's in the Academy. She directs She directed the season finale of Legion and the, episodes of Castle Rock for J.J. Abrams. And she's a real legitimate auteur. But we really started with her when, no one had heard of her. And that was from the ground up. And Mira is a similar example. I mean, Mira is the first female director in the Blue Tongue Collective out of Australia, Nash Edgerton and David Michaud and Joel Edgerton's filmmaker collective that they've been doing forever. But she was acting in their films and doing uncredited rewrites and helping them all out the same way that they were all helping each other out. But we got in with her on the ground level and helped her out with her first short film and gave her money for her second short film and really just built up with her till we could get her to her first feature film.
And Natalie, let's talk about the real support that you can offer as being someone from script to, you know, full on production.
Yeah, I mean, my goal is to find more of these filmmakers, especially female, mm-hmm. which would be amazing, mm-hmm. And we're doing that. But it's really just to help them support their vision. I want to always make sure that they feel like we're kind of taking care of them in the way that they need it in order to create something. So it's helping them script on set, in post, marketing, at every step of the way.
Fantastic. Yeah. And how are you guys using the film festival circuit to help fuel that?
You know, we really do try and attack it in every single way possible and slice up every way. You know, it's everything from Harmony's movie, The Beach Bum, with Matthew McConaughey and Jonah Hill and Martin Lawrence, Snoop Dogg. It's premiering at South by Southwest, opening weekend, big premiere. That's really being used as more of a commercial launch for audiences and for fans before we open it up at the end of the month. You know, a similar example would be Gaspar's movie Climax. We premiered it at Director's Fortnight at the Cannes Film Festival at One Director's Fortnight. That was really about reminding the world, you know, what a great auteur he is and the patina of his work. And at the same time, you know, he did that film completely with unknowns. It was the fastest film he ever did. He shot it in 7 days. It was the cheapest film he ever did.
And I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's on a bit of a Fassbinder kick. And he basically said, I made 4 films in 20 years and Fassbinder made 40 films in 10, so I need to pick up my pace. And,
wow.
Yeah, that's how Climax happened. But, you know, so we do things on that lofty level where it's about reminding people of a great auteur and making sure the fans know it's there. On the flip side, there's something like, you know, there's what we're doing out here, which is you have Scott, who's known as a Hollywood screenwriter, but he's not really known as a director. And even though he pulled together an incredible cast on The Report with Adam Driver and Annette Bening, Michael C. Hall, John Hamm, Ted Levine's in there. I mean, the man was Buffalo Bill.
Yeah.
And he's just as terrifying in this movie. But, you know, it's really taking a film that I think if you read a log line on a page may sound challenging because it's a deep political dive and it really gets into how our government works and everything. And it's a chance to say, hey, pay attention to this. And actually, this is a super engaging thriller. And it's like All the President's Men or 3 Days of the Condor, or one of these great 70s political thrillers that people don't really make anymore. On the flip side, then there's also situations like getting Rick Alverson's movie, The Mountain, to Venice, so that even though Venice is one of the great big lofty grand old festivals, it's taking, you know, a really wild original movie that he did and letting the world view it through the lens of, hey, this is important. This is an important specialty film. This is important art cinema. This is art. This is something you're going to be seeing in a film history book.
Well, I'll tell you, the lineup and the number the filmmakers involved, it's just one of the most exciting things that I've heard of for a while. Again, we've been talking with Natalie Ferry, Danny Gabay at Vice Studios. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks. Thank you so much for having us.
We're wrapping up day 2 of the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW, kcpw.org, bff.fm, and kfog.com. This show is made possible with the support of KCPW and Slamdance Film Festival. Our sponsors include Black Rain, hemp-infused products that focus on wellness, relief, and recovery, Studio Movie Grill, opening hearts and minds one story at a time, and Caroline Cromwell of Slope Style Realty of KW Park City Keller Williams Real Estate. Additional support is provided by Nasty Women Wines, Pro Bar, Uinta Brewing, Couple Co. Podcast, and Whole Foods Market in Park City. This show is audio produced by Charlene Goto, with production help from Angela Rowling and Sophie Gunther. Our executive producer is Lancia Wan. Tune in tomorrow when we'll be talking about the Sundance documentary Pahokee, Quarterlife Poetry, the episodic project out of Sundance, and Slam Dance's Desolation Center.